Blog Talk Radio.
I'm doing great, and you know, we haven't even given out the number, and we have a caller already, probably someone listening, but we'll check in a minute, so just hold on.
Let's do this. Let's get the caller, see what they want to ask us. Let's go right ahead, Don.
Okay.
Always never keep them holding.
Yeah, I understand.
All right.
Okay, caller, you're live on the air.
Hi, it's Satan.
Okay, we got a clown.
Okay.
Anyway.
Let me just say. Happy to hear from Satan.
Yeah.
What kind of telephone service do they have in hell?
Yeah.
Call back again, Satan, but go ahead.
Yeah, you know, we got a lot of things to cover today, and a lot of action happening out there in the community, locally, and nationally and internationally. And so I think we should just dig right into it.
All right, then. So what do we want to start? Oh,
yeah.
You know, my question to you, Mr. Allen, and maybe old Satan could call back. You slapped into 2-year-old black babies lately?
Oh, you let me catch someone laying a hand on a 2-year-old black baby. I beat the, you know, the
Lord monkey. Have mercy,
yeah,
the white tar out of them.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
Yes,
hey,
sir. We're talking about to our listening audience nationally and domestically and internationally. In fact, they carried it on the front page of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Johannesburg Times, of our major newspaper here in the state of Minnesota. A Caucasian. In fact, he is a part of the Aryan Brotherhood, really. It's been old Joe Rickey's thing. But he was on a flight, Delta, on a flight from Minneapolis to Atlanta, Georgia, on February 8th, flight 721. And during the descent of the aircraft, you know, there's a reduction and, I mean, you know, increase in pressure and et cetera. And a 2-year-old black baby, mother's name is Jessica Bennett, 33 years old. He started crying, and she was having a tremendous problem getting him to stop crying. And for those of us that are flyers and et cetera, we know what that cabin pressure can do. And Joe Rickey didn't like the baby, probably didn't even like the baby being alive, you know what I'm saying? And Joe Rickey out of Hayden, Idaho, a neo-Nazi sympathizer, we've been aware of him for quite some time, reached back and just slapped the baby right in the face, slapped this little 2-year-old baby, and some of the white passengers, to their credit, had to restrain him, Mr. Allen. So he was charged on federal charges, which makes sense because it was on a commercial carrier. He's been charged in Atlanta, in Georgia jurisdiction. His attorney said, oh, it was just kind of misunderstanding. You know what I'm saying? Just slap little black babies, 2-year-old black babies, anytime we go. Now, do you realize what would have happened, Mr. Allen, if that would have been a colored person, a negro, a black man that would have slapped a 2-year-old white baby on a domestic flight here in the United States?
Yeah, yeah. He would have been lynched, or she would have been lynched, whoever, before the flight even touched down.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
But like I said, we've known of Joe Rickey. Joe Rickey, by the way, allegedly has a company that allegedly makes some kind of parts and sells them to allegedly the federal government. We actually first came across him years ago when there were a number of mysterious deaths along Highway 90 going through the so-called panhandle of Idaho and some things that were going on north of the Highway 90 up in the place called Sandpoint. Boy, I tell you, that Sandpoint is a place where old Billy Bob and them get together. They do a lot of funny things up there. A lot of significant number of young black men come up dead up there in the last 15 years. But anyways, old Ricky is saying that it was a misunderstanding and the black woman had it wrong. And, you know, by the way, the baby was cut under his eye, so this man slapped him, slapped the little baby so hard that actually cut him. Now, normally in situations like that, I'm surprised the white man wasn't looking at at least a $500,000 bail.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, but I guess they'll work it out. So, but anyways, we felt obligated because the flight originated out of here. Though his point of flight was from Boise. He came in here from Boise, flew into Minneapolis here and caught the flight. But, you know, just to be so mean-spirited and so hostile and so racially animus to refer to a two-year-old child as a, and I have to use this word today over the program, to shut that nigga up,
mm-hmm.
Shut that nigga baby up, and then refer to her by derogatory names such as black bitch and things like that. That is really outrageous, but, you know, hey, I guess it's acceptable in America.
Yeah, this is absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, I was reading the news reports and the many comments on different websites, Mr. Edwards, throughout the United States, and I find it peculiar the people that run to the defense of the slapper rather than seeing, you know, that, you know, this guy was obviously wrong, and, you know, it's just what a difference a race makes.
Oh, I like that, Mr. We should make that a Broadway song.
Yeah.
What a difference a race makes.
Yeah.
Lord have mercy. We're not talking about NASCAR and Billy Bob driving his Chevy. We talking in terms of the race of a two-year-old black child slapped by a 60-year-old white Nazi sympathizer on a flight over the southern United States. I'm not surprised, Mr. Allen, by the comments that I'm also seeing on computer.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, you know, these same people were outraged with respect to what happened out there in Southern California, which been so much misinformation coming from that, just as there's misinformation about a massive, over 300 combatants at one of our local high schools, which actually is supposed to be the prize. So we got so much. I don't want to jump all around and confuse people, but we felt obligated, Mr. Allen and myself, to at least critique this and force the country to take a look at what happened on Flight 721.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And Mr. Edwards, you know, I just want to get into this for real quick for a minute. You know, last night there was a celebration it was a fundraiser for a local organization here called Turning Point, which is a chemical dependency treatment center, culturally specific and oriented toward African Americans. But I mean, they take anybody. And it was honoring a longtime professor here in the Twin Cities, Professor Mahmoud El-Kate, African-American Studies professor.
Mm-hmm.
And after the event, you know, I saw State Senator Bobby Joe Champion, the president of the Minneapolis Urban League, Scott Gray, and the CEO of Stairstep Foundation, Alfred Babington Johnson. And so
are they still in business? I thought they stopped paying their employees.
Yeah, well, that's what I heard, you know. I mean, I had some good sources. And so I proceeded, you know, everyone's black tie event, and I'm suited up pretty good. The Minneapolis Fifth Ward Councilman Don Samuels agreed to take a picture with me. He was very, very happy to do that. We took a picture, you know, I'm feeling like I'm on the road. So I'm going to walk over here to Senator Bobby Joe Champion and extend my hand and say, hey, Senator Champion, congratulations. Senator Champion looked at me and said, I'm not shaking your hand.
Mm.
And I said, why, Bobby? I call him Bobby because we grew up together in Minneapolis. I know him from church and, you know, I wasn't disrespecting him. He says, well, you write all that crazy stuff, but it's not factual. I said, Bobby Joe, can you tell me one thing that's not factual? And so he had an audience there of Babington Johnson and Scott Gray, president of the Minneapolis Urban League. Now, both of those other gentlemen did shake my hand. And so I'm standing there and I'm talking to him. And I said, you know, Bobby Joe, you know, I've asked you questions and sent you emails. And, you know, poking fun at politicians is part of a journalist's duty. You know, if you're doing something, I mean, if you recall, Mr. Edwards, when they opened up the Nice Ride, the bicycle in North Minneapolis, I recorded
right there in front of the police station.
Yeah, exactly. I recorded a video where Senator Champion suggested it would be okay for people from North Minneapolis to ride their bikes to Eden Prairie to play their Comcast bill.
Yeah, he was a state representative at that time,
And it was just totally hilarious and ludicrous. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I've gotten some rare moments of him talking crazy on videotape. It wasn't me. I didn't have my hand up his butt moving his mouth. He was doing the talking, and I was holding the camera. And so he felt very, you know, disrespected, he told me, just upset. And I says, well, you know, you don't answer questions. And he says, well, ask me one question. I said, well, Bobby Joe, from October 2010 to May 2011, MnDOT received $68 million in federal funds. And MnDOT is a state organization.
Why don't we let people know you're talking about the Minnesota Department of Transportation.
Yeah, Minnesota Department of Transportation. And I said, at that time, you were the vice chair of the oversight committee. And first thing you did, well, Governor Pawlenty was the governor. I said, I'm not talking about Governor Pawlenty. I'm talking about MnDOT, Minnesota Department of Transportation, and the $68 million they received between the time frame I just mentioned. And I asked him, I says, you said nothing when all they spent was $715 with one black contractor out of $68 million. And he said, well, that was federal funds, federal funds. I said, wait a minute. MnDOT, Minnesota Department of Transportation, is a state organization. You are the oversight. Okay.
State agency.
Okay. And so I don't care if that money comes from Pluto. You know, you are somehow responsible for speaking up, especially being who you are. You know, you have a right as an elected official to speak up and ask these questions. Well, you know, I don't even think he knew about it, Mr. Edwards, number one.
Okay.
And then I had all three of them's attention at that point because Bobby Joe, as you know, Senator Champion, gets really flamboyant like he's directing a choir and wants to challenge you and brings the lawyer out of him, which I told him several times. I said, you need to get rid of the lawyer out of this conversation because, you know, I mean, I'm not worried about that part of it. So let's have a conversation. So then I went on to talk to him about, I said, did you know on December 20th, 2012, a 22-year-old African-American college student.
College student, yes.
DeMario Booker was beaten into a coma by Minneapolis police. And I happened to look at Babington Johnson, Bobby Joe Champion, Senator Champion, and Scott Gray, President of the Urban League. Mm-hmm. I says, none of you black men said anything.
Mm-hmm.
Not a word.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, oh, well, we didn't know about that. I was like, oh, okay. Says, well, you're not where you're supposed to be, I guess. And then I asked Scott Gray, president of the Urban League, because the Urban League, Minneapolis Urban League, is written into the legislation for the stadium.
Yeah, sure is.
And I guess this is a nice segue into the stadium piece. But I says, you know, they dropped the goals down to 11%, and if I wasn't mistaken, it's 11% construction and workforce. And Mr. Scott Gray wanted to battle me on that. And says, no, it's 32%, and. And I asked him, well, what plans do you have to get people employed? And he says, well, we got big plans for that. And the thing is, Mr. Edwards, as you know, as we've reported for the last 5 years, myself, you, the last 20, 30 years, that this is a big song and dance, okay? What they'll use, you know, this is not about getting special interest group jobs. This is about having special interest groups to get in front of the WCCO news cameras and say, yeah, Massa, we got some jobs on that there stadium. And they never do. They're never in compliance. So that's all this is about.
Yeah, well, we want to make sure we also, to our listening audience, and we'll also give that number out again, and that is that the chairwoman, who is a very well-respected Minnesotan, Michelle Kalm, Haglund indicated in a interview with Minnesota Public Radio last week that there aren't the numbers qualified African Americans that are currently in the state of Minnesota listed by, you know, workforce category who are eligible to be able to work on the site. And also the numbers for whites are pretty tight, if you will, that they can actually find a sufficient number. Now, the figures that came out of the meeting yesterday morning at the Metrodome in the Halsey Hall Room was that 7,500 individuals, human beings, will be employed in the construction of this stadium, which has to be completed by July 1 or thereabouts of 2016. If not, there will be $5 million penalty for each game that's missed, including exhibition games. Well, what is kind of troubling about that is that when African Americans had been saying that that was the situation of, you know, you were attacked and blasted and blasphemed and et cetera. Now, the white chairwoman of the authority, as I said, who is a political power, a direct appointee of the governor of the state of Minnesota, the Democrat Mark Dayton, she says it, and there isn't a whimper, except for what, you know, apparently you ran into at this activity yesterday. Now, the other problem is M.A. Mortensen, who received the contract, and, man, there must have been a lot of envelopes passed around under the table on this one. But the U.S. attorney and the attorney general are not going to investigate it. But M.A. Mortensen has no successful history of diversity, integration, compliance, or whatever else you want to call it. M.A. Mortensen just does not put black people on their construction sites. They talked about them doing the Ed Jones football stadium in St. Louis. You talk to the brothers and sisters of St. Louis, man, they, you know, with the exception of a small number that were forced on Mortensen by very heavy-hitting black political types in St. Louis, there was really no significant African-American presence based on the black population of St. Louis, Missouri. So I have no anticipation that there will be anything beyond the 1 to 1.5% that I've talked about. Now, I understand yesterday, last night, Mr. Gray and others attempted to correct and get your mind right, is that the 32% figure is going to include both construction contracts and construction workers. Here's my question, and the phone lines are going to be open here. We know that some of y'all, you know, who are part of the troop, the Amos and Andy troop, are out there listening. How many of these African Americans that all you brothers out there said that you trained, be it OIC or the Urban League or whatever, how many of them are now currently journeymen? And can you identify what specific trade unions that they're in?
Oops. Well, Mr. Harris, I mean, what are you saying here? Because I'm kind of like getting mixed messages and mixed signals, because we have this OIC in North Minneapolis that says they train and have all these people ready. And then you just told me the lady was on NPR, Margaret Kelm Hagelin, saying that
Michelle.
We don't have.
She said the numbers are not here. The numbers of African American, quote unquote, persons of color are not present in the workforce, that not going to be able to meet anything approaching the goal, be it 11% or 6%, may be able to reach a goal of 1.5. Now, there will be allegedly 7,500 workers will be hired, and what Mortensen's representative, Mr. Wood, who is the chief executive officer of Mortensen, interestingly said yesterday and then again on television, he'll be on tomorrow morning on a program on CCO. He and Les Bagley, the representative of the Vikings, who are really not happy with the selection, he indicated that the daily workforce on the stadium will be about 1,500 a day. So there'll be as many as 1,500 workers out there. And so that means, you know, you can certainly drive by in after October of this year, and you'll see at least 400 or 500, or certainly 300 to 400 African Americans. Oh, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, because we found out, didn't we, Mr. Allen, that there is no commitment to a category for African Americans that they could achieve. Let's say they could achieve the 32% minority goal and never hire a single African American. I'm sorry, I apologize. What was I thinking about? This is called the Michael Jordan doctrine. This is a man by the name of the same name of the basketball player, named Michael Jordan, who was the executive director of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department for about 4 years. He put in place the doctrine, and it's been effective, in which you could set a number, and what you would do, you would not compartmentalize it, and you could make sure that you never hired a single black person. And that's basically what has happened in this city. So,
and that's, they've even said that about the St. Paul Saints ballpark. I mean, you asked the lady point blank at the meeting last week that you could actually build the whole stadium, the ballpark, baseball park for the St. Paul Saints in downtown St. Paul, and never hire a black person. And she said, yeah, or a minority. She said, yeah.
No, she said black. I said black. I mean, and she said, you're absolutely correct. And all these contractors of color just kind of sat there. All these leaders of construction, the construction industry in the black community, as well as the representatives of both the stadium authority or the facilities authority, the Ryan Company, who will be building the Saints Stadium in downtown St. Paul, they all sat there, and no one, you know, took exception to what she said in response to the inquiry from myself, and that is, you could build that stadium and not hire a single African-American. And that's what's going to happen with the People's Stadium in downtown Minneapolis. They will not hire any more than about 1% African-American. So that means, you know, 35 or 40 African-Americans may get hired over a. So, hey, you know, that's the stadium. But let's give that phone number, because
I would think
that a lot of defenders of the 32% goal should be just, you know, salivating to take us on this.
Yeah, exactly. That number is 347-426-3904, 347-426-3904. The phone lines are open. Please give us a call. I mean, there's a lot of things going on. But anyway, Ms. Edwards, to conclude this little powwow we had last night with this triad, Bobby Joe Champion, Senator Champion, Scott Gray, President of the Urban League, and Stair Step Foundation's Alfred Babington Johnson. I mean, it's very interesting for me as someone who writes a lot of stories, does a lot of research, is to see how out of touch.
Don, you're breaking up just a tad on the reception there.
Yeah. All right.
Better. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just seeing it really unusual that how out of touch these people are with the reality of the people, the African Americans in Minnesota, or black Minnesotans, because it's really disheartening to even listen to them talk. And it would be even more interesting, Mr. Edwards, to even get them in a public forum and put some hard questions to them with the community sitting there.
Oh, by the way, on that particular note, hold your thought there. Tomorrow, up in Shingle Creek, which is a community in the far north end of Minneapolis, bordering a small community called Brooklyn Center, the Council on Black Minnesotans are going to be holding a town forum on some level of dealing with violence and guns and gun legislation. It'll be at the Shingle Creek Library. You know, you may want to check the time. I think it'll be sometime, obviously, I think in the afternoon. I'm not sure. Council on Black Minnesotans. Yeah,
I am
first public forum they've had in I don't know when.
Yeah, I am looking for that. I thought I had saw that on Facebook somewhere, and I'm
it's there. So if you find the time, we want to give folks the time. But that moves us as we move right along to the racial and nationalistic battle that took place at the largest high school here in the city of Minneapolis, South High School, a little over 2,000 students, over 300 Somalis squared off against African Americans and Native Americans in a massive fight in the lunchroom and the commons area. Minneapolis Star Tribune, Johannesburg Times, attempting to write a exclusive in this morning's edition of the paper, following on the heels of an article in Friday morning's edition. The reporter, Steve Brandt, and a female reporter, attempting to give a timeline. And I have to say to the Johannesburg Times Star Tribune that the timeline is incorrect, that it was not the first period of lunch. It was the second period. that this confrontation broke out when someone threw and hit an African-American football player with a carton of milk. You know, that can hurt, you know, particularly if it's filled, which it was. And he demanded to know who did it. He was laughed at. And, of course, he took an action, which is certainly not justifiable. He threw a chair, a metal chair, and hit a Somali student, female student, knocking her to the floor. And that's when the battle broke out. And because it was the changing of the second to the third period lunch, over 300 students came together. In fact, there is a commons area as you come up the steps from the lunchroom. There's a landing. And over 100 combatants were fighting. The teachers were injured. Police were ordered in. The Star Tribune says 10. There was a picture on two of the TV stations yesterday showing police on the occasion of Thursday's confrontation. There's a whole lot more police than 10. And by the way, I have to say to our local folks who love Mayor R.T. Ryback, there was not a single black officer in this group of at least 17 white officers, if you will. Black officers really couldn't be found. But again, the Star Tribune has the Los Angeles Times in the situation involving the black police officer out there. Star Tribune, again, not having accurate information with respect to what happened. But the leaders were meeting yesterday at the school attempting to get contracts to allegedly come in and settle this up.
Right. So let's use this. Ms. Edwards, we have a caller on
the line. Oh, let's get them in.
We have actually a couple callers here.
Let's get them in. Have the other one wait. Let's go. We get both of them in.
Yeah, you're live on the air, sir.
Hello.
Hello, you're live on the air.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Swag. Swag. I look like Vince McMahon.
Okay, that's a clown.
Now, Swag, is that something, is that a Broadway show?
I have no idea.
I thought maybe that was Lizzie Mazzelli or somebody.
Yeah, yeah. One of the little fans was Lil Wayne.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Swag, swag. I know what that is. Swag is their mother's name.
Yeah, here we go. Hello, you are live on the air, caller.
It doesn't fit in my phone.
757.
I don't think they know they're on.
757, you're live on the air. Okay.
Well, cut them off. Tell them to come back. Call back.
And then we have you're live on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes, you're live on the air, sir.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. This is B.A. calling in from Maryland. Let me just quickly say it. It's amazing that on these type of shows, shows that where African-Americans are talking about things that interest African-Americans, that you get these type of prank callers. You know, it says a lot about our country and where we have not come to. But nevertheless, here's my question. I was watching a documentary on Whitney Young. Do you know if Whitney Young, is he from Minnesota, Minneapolis? Did he spend time in Minnesota?
Yes, he did. Whitney Young, and let us so people, because people get confused and think you're talking about, you know, the singer, you know, Whitney Houston. I mean, that's how confused people get, you know. Whitney Young was the head of the Urban League in the 1960s. He died of a heart attack, allegedly, while on a beach in Mother Africa. At the height of his career and power, I had the opportunity to know him to the extent of being in some meetings early in the in the mid 1960s. But Whitney Young was in fact here, as was Roy Wilkins, were here for a period of time in positions of working within the civil rights community. In fact, Roy Wilkins lived for a number of years in the 1920s. In early 30s, in our sister city of St. Paul. Whitney Young was here for a brief period in the late 1930s with the Urban League of Minneapolis in a administrative role. So, yes, sir, your inquiry is absolutely correct. Whitney Young was here in Minnesota for a period of time.
Yeah, he received his degree in master's degree in social work from the University of Minnesota.
There you go.
And my last question is, you know, about man, it was 20 years ago or so. I almost moved to Minneapolis, the Twin Cities. I actually got a job offer from a corporation there. Tell me, Minnesota, Minneapolis is known. It's a corporate a town. A lot of Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies. A lot of strong, good corporate companies are headquartered in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the surrounding metropolitan area.
Mm-hmm.
Are these corporations, in your opinion, as corporations go, are they progressive when it comes to hiring African Americans and other minorities?
Not African Americans. Now, when you say other minorities, as you probably you are a listener, and we appreciate that you've been with us for some time and listened very intently. The minority game is being played to the hilt, and as we were talking earlier on this program, we now see minorities being denied, being compartmentalized, if you will, or categorized. And so the corporations hire persons of color, but they're basically foreigners. Oops. Attractiveness towards the Chinese, if you will, Indonesians, even folks from the Middle East. Now, as it pertains to African Americans, we are extremely non-progressive here as it pertains to the hiring of African Americans in corporate Minnesota.
Yeah, and in Minnesota, we have 19 of the Fortune 1000 companies, with the top five being United Health Group, Target, Best Buy, Super Value, 3M, Medtronics, I keep going down here, General Mills, Land O'Lakes, Excel, Ameriprise, Hormel Food, Thrive-In Financial for Lutherans, Ecolabs, St. Jude Medical, and Nash Finch rounds off the bottom of the list there. But, Mr. Evers, like you were just saying, I was in City Center yesterday because I had to go down to Office Depot to pick up some business cards. And I was shocked at the number of people from other countries wearing Target shirts down there.
Oh, yes. In fact, in that Target building, and caller, hopefully you're still with us from out of Maryland, what has happened here is that we have a large number of East Indians, in other
mm-hmm.
words, from India, Bangladesh, to some degree Pakistan, though we're not, you know, hot on the Muslims here, per se, but as you know, India is primarily a Hindu nation, though there is certainly a significant Muslim population also in India. But these folks from India are being brought in here, and they're working in the area of marketing, and they are the folks that now answer the telephone once they return to the native country and pretend that they're just down the street from you and talk
mm-hmm.
to you about your obligation and your bills and et cetera, right?
Yeah, yes. And we have another caller, Mr.
All right, let's get him.
Hello, you're live on the air.
Minorities.
Hello, you're live on the air, 757.
Yeah. Good morning, or good afternoon, should I say.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. What can we do for you? What's your question?
I posted a couple of questions on Facebook, and one of them has to do with the political system there in Minneapolis. I heard it from a, you know, interesting party that Jackie Cherry Holmes was going to be running for, throwing her hat in a race as for mayor. And I was just wondering what your take on that was. What I was told is that a lot of the poverty pimps in Minnesota that you so eloquently talk about are the ones that are pushing and will be supporting her. What do you think?
Let my colleague, Mr. Allen, go first, and I'll go second, because I've known Jackie probably longer than the average person. Oops. Go ahead.
I understand it,
Ron. Yeah. Okay, well, I find it very interesting that people like Al McFarlane and others are telling certain community members that Jackie Cherry Holmes will be the next mayor of Minneapolis, or that people should support her. I think it's time to snap that particular thread altogether. As far as her personal stuff, you know, like I said, I haven't really known her for 5-6 years really, and don't really care nor much more than I do now, but I think it's going to be an interesting race. We'll see what's happening. Mr. Edwards.
To your question, caller, number one, I think that Ms. Cherry Holmes does stand a very strong chance because of her development background, if you will, and particularly in light of, you know, how she's been positioned with the West Broadway Association, so-called Development Association. She has a lot of money that she's going to be able to access. I think it could very well come down to her and Gary Schiff, Democrat 9th Ward here in Minneapolis. But back to Ms. Cherry Holmes. Ms. Cherry Holmes has had a long history of knowing how to maneuver and direct and keep African American, particularly African American males, keep their minds right. And so in that regards, I think she is the favorite right now. If she officially throws her hat into the ring, and I'm not sure that she's made an official announcement of her candidacy, but she very well could become the next mayor. Now, the thing that fascinates me about my community, and I've lived here in Minneapolis since 1945, is that she was the person who defeated the first elected black council member, the late Van White. And some of the people that Mr. Allen, his example, named were right in the forefront of helping to sabotage and to destroy Councilman Van White. Now, and actually, by the way, just so people understand about this great liberal enclave, we've only had four African-Americans as council members, and that started 30 years ago, and that was Van White, Sharon Sells Belton, Brian Herron, and, of course, Don Samuels. And so we, you know, we don't fall over backwards electing African-Americans to powerful positions. But to your question, caller, I think that Ms. Cherry Holmes has the command, if you will, of the so-called black leadership here in the city of Minneapolis.
Hello?
I think she may have cut off. I think she got the answer she expected.
And then we have a caller from Maryland back.
Let's get him.
Okay, welcome back, sirs. Hello, you're on the line. You're live on the air. Okay, he disappeared there.
Okay.
That's okay.
Give that phone number again, Don, in case folks want to call in, because we've dealt with a couple of things. We have not moved to the California situation yet and want to do that in the next couple of minutes because that is really a hot issue.
Yes. The number to call in is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. We have a caller calling back.
Oh, let's get him.
You're live on the air.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I got cut off there somehow.
Okay.
I heard you say that you were talking about the black council members, and I seem to remember a pretty strong sister up there, Natalie Johnson Lee.
Oh, that's right.
Who also was the one that upset Jackie.
Yeah, she upset Jackie, but unfortunately, she only lasted one term before the Brotherhood worked to oust her.
Well, wasn't that due to redistricting her?
Well, they put Don Samuels, who at one point was the councilman in the 3rd Ward, while Natalie was the councilwoman in the 5th Ward. They redistricted, you're absolutely correct. In fact, they took a significant part of the 5th Ward from out of downtown, which shrunk the tax base in the 5th Ward, and they put Don and Natalie in the same ward, and that was the end of Natalie.
Well, since you said that she's going to have a lot of the African American male leaders supporting her, is that a correct assumption to say that those same African American leaders might fall under that category of the poverty pimps that have always been plaguing our community?
Why, certainly, and I think you know that these are the same poverty pimps that helped to position the defeat of Natalie Johnson Lee by Don Samuels.
Okay, these are the same
individuals that caused that to happen, and they were very much opposed to her being Natalie Johnson Lee in her campaign. And one of the greatest upsets, by the way, it was one of the greatest upsets in the history of Minnesota politics when this novice, Natalie Johnson Lee, defeated Jackie Cherry Holmes. Jackie Cherry Holmes had served for 11 and a half years and had been council president for about 6. Mr. Allen, you remember that?
Yes.
And so it was quite an upset, but no sooner than Johnson Lee had won, leadership in, quote-unquote, our community sent word to her that unless she knew how to play the game, she was through. And they worked very hard 4 years later to defeat her.
I guess my next question, are I probably would go on and talk a little bit. I know the St. Paul Urban League is now defunct. They no longer have an Urban League. Southside, I was told that that's in non-existent. So the only thing for African Americans is the Minneapolis Urban League. Is that correct?
Well, first of all, the Southside Urban League is a part of the Minneapolis Urban League. That's just their Southside office. And you're right, that office is now vacant. There's no activities there. The Minneapolis Urban League is down to probably about 7 staff people from a high of 135 under the leadership of another person.
Okay. Well, being that the Minneapolis Urban League is, you know, the representative for the people in the community, do they have any obligations or responsibilities to the people in the community? And if they do, what are they?
Well, allegedly they do in a number of areas. Number one, their charter. The charter of the Urban League dictates what their relationship is to be to the Negro community, if you will. That was what the language was when the Urban League was created. In fact, the Urban League was initially called the Industrial League, and then it became the Urban League. So when it was first founded back in the early 1920s, it was the Industrial League, and then it became the Urban League. It has a specific mission statement. Its mission statement talks in terms of its obligation to the Negro community / African American community / community of African American color. And so they clearly know what their mission is, if you will. They are totally under the control of the National Urban League, but the National Urban League has indicated how it deals with affiliates, and that's the appropriate name. People sometimes get it confused. The NAACP are branches. The Urban League are affiliates. The National signed off on the demise and the shutdown of the St. Paul Urban League. And I have to tell you, madam, for wherever you're calling from, the Minneapolis Urban League is right on the cliff, right on the edge of the abyss with respect to going under also.
Okay, would they have some kind of duty to assist or to keep children in the community safe?
Oh, absolutely. All of them do, but they don't.
Well, it's my understanding that a convicted pedophile is working there, has been out front as their spokesman on the news, I believe Carrie Levin News, and is also using his ties in the community to work with drill teams and other organizations and singing birthday grams or telegrams
to
children.
Yes. We've heard that. Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that true?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you may know that a year ago, that person was asked to leave a park in North Minneapolis, North Commons, because someone reported him to the police as being in the park around children, which was contrary to the conditions of his parole.
Okay, but as I understand it, that person is probably off parole now. He's not required, even as a convicted sex offender, a pedophile who molested
But he's registered.
I was unable to find that name in the registry.
He's been registered. Yeah, and you're talking in terms of his presence at a house on the corner of 13th and Morgan.
No, actually, I think I'm talking about the presence of him at the hospitality house at a children's event.
Well, I'm talking about where he lived, but go ahead.
Okay, no, I would never say anything like that.
Okay. Well, I would, because in that you brought it up, I mean, we need to be as transparent as possible. Because there has been controversy about the presence of the individual as a spokesperson and as an actively engaged individual around children. And that's, you know, but again, that's the community's responsibility to deal with that. You know, I know that questions have been posed to the leadership of the Urban League, how they deal with it. You know, that the community will have to determine if it's satisfactory.
So are these young children's parents aware that even though we throw him out there on a pedestal as a community leader?
Some are.
Mm-hmm.
What can be done to make the rest of them aware and let them have the decision?
You're doing that on this program. For many that listen, and we have a pretty vast audience for blog radio, and people will be on the phone or probably on the phone as you're speaking, talking in terms of this situation. some will be talking in terms of the audacity of Ron and Don to respond to your questions with such detail and specificity. Others will be saying they didn't know, and then others will be saying this is something we need to look into.
Well, I mean, he's already been named on name, but what's the problem with naming him on your show so that these parents that are listening, like, oh, my God.
Why don't you name him? Because you're the one that called in. Why don't you name him?
Well, you know, I mean, it's your show. I hate to steal your thunder.
No, you won't steal our thunder. Go ahead and name him.
I mean,
not be talking about the same person. Why don't you name him?
I just understand that Mr. Barber has access to children, and I know his past. I've known some of his victims, and... Yeah. I understand that sex offenders are sex offenders, and he's paid his time. He's paid his debt to society, but he is also a child molester, a predator. And when it comes to child molesters or predators, the jury is still out on whether they can ever be rehabilitated. I pray that he is. I pray that he is. But I think parents have a right to know that that's who their children are around.
Well, we understand here at On Point, Mr. Allen and ourselves, before we went on the air as we were doing our production, we understand there's quite a bit of chatter on social media about this. Apparently this situation re-engaged itself. So let us hope as we conclude this that certainly folks will decide to do something and certainly raise the appropriate questions, if you will. But again, as I said, I can't speak for my associate, Mr. Allen, but the onus is on the community, you know, and particularly those that are aware that their children have been exposed to a situation which has serious moral and legal consequences. Okay?
Well,
appreciate it.
All
right. Thank you. All right.
Thank you.
All right. Interesting call. You know, hope folks don't get upset with us. But we're not going to sit here, Mr. Allen, you know what I'm saying, play dumb.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But here's what I wanted. I want to move to the California situation because it gripped the nation for 10 days, and Anderson Cooper and others on CNN are now trying to put the right twist on this. There is a manifesto, Mr. Allen, as we discussed in the production meeting, in which Christopher Darnan laid out in 11 pages what happened to him in the Los Angeles Police Department prior to his actions, which we, as we said last week, we certainly don't concur with. I thought we had a very interesting and in-depth call out of California. We later found out that this was an individual that called us last week, was very knowledgeable about what was happening. But a couple of things I feel obligated as a journalist to do. Number one, much of the information that the media was giving us on the date of the firefight and the ultimate death of the ex-LA cop was not correct. Example, in fact, they even had illustrations. When I say illustrations, I'm talking about pictorial illustrations of two women allegedly laying on the floor, tied up. These were allegedly the maids and et cetera. There were no maids. It was not cleaning women or maids and et cetera. The two people that were tied up were a husband and wife. They were the owners, not only of the house. People keep saying cabin, too. They were the owners of that resort at Big Bear. And the media continued to carry that particular fallacy right up until the couple, the Reynolds, by the way. That's the name of the owners, the Reynolds. Came on live television at about 8:45 Central Standard Time and talked about what had happened, including the fact that Mr. Darner indicated that he had no intention of harming them, just as he had not harmed the guy on the boat in San Diego, but also as well as the fact that he really chose not to create havoc with the command center because for 5 days, Mr. Darner was directly across the street from the command center for 5 days. He watched them out the window of that facility. And I think that that's absolutely frightening and chilling in light of all the information that we were being fed as the American public about how the search was going and where they thought he was, where they didn't think he was, and then what kind of killer that he was, and et cetera. Again, we certainly do not endorse or sign off, and certainly our condolences go to the victims, but the fact of the matter is you've got to read his manifesto because it is chilling when he talks in terms of what has happened. And I've talked to some black law enforcement officers here in our own city, and they say it seems like a mirror image of what has happened to black police officers in this department, particularly the Mill City Five, and particularly back in 2005, 6, and 7, and what the history was. So anyways, wanted to kind of just kind of get that onto the record for our listening audience and et cetera. And I don't think that we'll ever know what the real truth was about how he was railroaded.
Yeah, you know, a second officer, Mr. Edwards, former LAPD officer Joe Jones released a manifesto, which can be found on freakoutnation.com. Says the title, the headline is "A Second Former LAPD Officer Releases Manifesto," and it's pretty convicting against the LAPD.
Also, an officer by the name of Bentley, spelled like the automobile, wrote a book in 1966. He, in fact, was on Anderson Cooper on Wednesday night, and they cut him off allegedly to switch to the press conference, never brought him back. Anderson Cooper was in the process of asking him the following question: well, haven't things changed in the LAPD? And Brother Bentley, who was a 10-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department, said, no, nothing's changed. In fact, it's even worse. In fact, let me just say this, because so many people missed that interview because of censorship by CNN. He was challenged by Anderson Cooper to say why, and he talked about Bentley. Officer Bentley talked about when he first came on the LAPD, and his training officer, who was white, said to him right off the bat, Bentley's words were, he looked him directly in the eye and told him, you've got no business being here, and my job is to make sure you don't make it, because you were a lucky nigger because you fell through the cracks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That was attested to by Mr. Bentley. I've talked to some other black law enforcement officers in Los Angeles, here in the Twin Cities, and et cetera. They have read his book, which came out years ago, and they said that all of this has been authenticated. And so, contrary to what Chief Beck says and others and Mayor Villagosa says and et cetera, nothing's changed in the LAPD.
Wow, that's very interesting. Yeah, there's you know, a lot going on behind that still, and hopefully the feds investigate that.
No. The federal authorities can't investigate it. I mean, they won't, Don.
Okay.
They've got to cover for the LAPD, because this thing has really exploded. There were so many lies told on the deceased, Mr. Dorner, that they can't afford to ever correct this. So what we will hear in about 6 weeks, is that there was an internal investigation, and the decision to terminate Christopher was affirmed, if you will, and let's just move on.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, though, Don, a lot of tensions in L.A. within the black community and other communities of racial color. A lot of tensions.
Interesting. Hey, Ms. Harris, by the way, earlier in the show, we were talking about that meeting in Brooklyn Center tomorrow, Sunday. It's at 6125 Shingle Creek Parkway in Brooklyn Center, and it's the African American Action Coalition, AAAC, and it's from 3 to 5 p.m. tomorrow.
And that's on Sunday, this Sunday, right?
This Sunday, yeah.
Okay.
5 p.m.
Yeah.
Might have to stumble over there and see what is going on, you know? So
yeah.
So that's what's happening.
Okay. Anything else? Any other calls? Let's get that number one more time. Maybe someone wants to shoot through. We've had a couple very interesting calls.
Yes, we have.
Some will be very, very controversial.
Again, that number is 347-426-3904, 347-426-3904, and the phone lines are still open here in the last 7 minutes of the show. Give us a call if you have a interesting topic or you just want to challenge us. We'd appreciate it.
I really thought we would be getting something on the racial tensions at South High School and the massive fight, I mean, which there were injuries. And over 300 combatants fighting. I've had police officers indicate to me that they've never seen anything like that in their life, you know, in a Minneapolis high school. Our superintendent, unfortunately, has not been able, if you've not seen her in front of the cameras, she's out of the country or was out of the country, and so she was not able to be here in a timely manner. But, you know, I know that board members. In fact, two board members on the Minneapolis Public Schools board of directors have children that go to they go to South. I'll choose not to name them unless somebody calls and asks, but there are two school board members who have, one has a son, the other one has a daughter there. But anyways, I am aware that, both of their children have been saying to them, as school board members, that there were significant and dangerous problems at South. So I'm kind of puzzled about all these folk who are coming forward now saying that they knew about this and et cetera. Then the question becomes, well, particularly in that you're asking for contracts, so what did you do about it?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And there's another thing that's troubling me is this bullying stuff that, you know, they're trying to make a big deal out of bullying. And, I mean, I don't know what to think about it. All I can do is think back to when I was in the Minneapolis public schools. It was tradition for the sophomores to get their heads stuck in the toilet by the seniors.
Ooh, okay.
I don't understand what the – I've been really reading a lot of stories about this, and last week I read a story, and it seems like some GLBT children got harassed in school that kind of set off this whole bullying movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just really trying to figure it out, and if there's anybody out there that can explain why there was such a march.
Well, Don, wasn't bullying initially – an issue that was advanced that was really going to deal with threatening black students? I'm talking about students, black students, who just by their mere presence was a threat, considered to be a threat, were too militant, too black, too aggressive. I mean, that's really what the bullying debate was about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, when it kind of hit the national scene, is to get a handle on getting even more black students out of the public school system, if you will. It kind of began to take on a different life of its own, if you will. And people, I think, haven't been very honest. It's kind of like the elephant in the room. People haven't been very honest about the question you just raised. I mean, what is the real genesis for the issue of bullying? Because bullying has been going on for a long time, okay? But I've solved documentation. In fact, there was a report done in 2006 by a committee appointed by Mayor R.T. Ryback, which was then presented by him to the League of Cities in 2009, in which in that particular manifesto, and we're talking about that, he indicated that the problem of crime and other things was a part of the mental health problem of black youth, particularly males. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and bullying was a part of what was being discussed as a kind of a therapeutic approach to dealing with the, oops, black problem.
Yeah.
But you can't talk about that. So that's why I'm puzzled now about all these folks who are talking about the problems at South. I didn't think, you know, after what happened in Washburn, I thought we were all told in the colored community, the black community, that we were way off base. There is no problem.
Yes, yes. That's what you think. But, you know, these schools are a hotbed right now, especially with, you know, the Somalian and immigrant saturation, in the schools, and the defining of Black Americans and Somali students and who they are and what they represent, and some people aren't having it, especially at school, because number one, the Minneapolis public schools aren't teaching any of the children to be critical thinkers. That's the first thing.
Absolutely.
And the second thing is that, you know, you're just basically in there, what, 4, 5, 6 hours a day being taught how to pass a test. And so and so when it comes to the point of dealing with who someone is, and, you know, we can look at race, but race is something that was just, you know, made up in the last few hundred years, you know, by someone other than us, black people. And so, I mean, that creates a huge problem. And so I hope these people, they get their contracts and, you know, their little money to go in there and do whatever they can do. And, you know, like you said, after Washburn, we thought this was nipped in the bud. But, you know, it's not. And it's hard to say when it will be. But we're right under a minute and a half, Mr. Edwards. Any closing words?
Well, I look forward to the breakdown of anticipated inclusion of African Americans in the building of the Target or the People's Stadium / Viking Stadium. Groundbreaking will take place in October. There's some preliminary work that's already supposedly started, but I'm going to be very interested in seeing the breakdown, particularly when the latest figures are 7,500 workers, an average of 1,500 workers will be on site each and every day after October. So we should see a lot of black folk, man.
Yeah.
250 to 350 black folk every day out there on the People's Stadium for the next 3.5 years.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank everybody for listening to On Point. We'll be back next Saturday, 3 p.m. Central Standard Time.